Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, August 20th, 2021. As we do every week, we check in today with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me as usual with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So the week opened with a bang, Andrew. The news that Hachette will acquire independent publisher Workman, whose eclectic catalog includes What to Expect When You're Expecting, The Preppy Handbook, and The Barbecue Bible.
Yeah, another major deal, and the biggest trade publishers continue to get larger. As you said, the news this week is that the Hachette Book Group has entered into a binding commitment to acquire one of the industry's largest and most distinct independent publishers, Workman Publishing. It's a minor deal in the scheme of things. You know, it's not a Simon & Schuster, but Hachette is going to be paying $240 million for Workman, which had sales of about $134 million last year, and the deal is expected to be completed by the end of September. When the acquisition is completed, Workman Publishing will become Hachette's eighth publishing group. It will comprise the imprints Workman, Algonquin, Algonquin Young Readers, Artisan Story, and Timber Press. And the new group is going to be led by Workman Publishing's current CEO, Dan Reynolds, who's going to report to Hachette CEO Michael Peach, and he's going to join Hachette's executive management board. And I'll just say this right now, right up front. I love this deal for Hachette. You know, consolidation and all that other stuff, we can talk about those issues and debate them at another time. But full disclosure, my sister-in-law worked at Workman for a short time, and she raved about the culture and what a special place it was. And I just have always held Workman in such high esteem. And they are simply great publishers with a real niche, a really well-defined niche, and a rather large and profitable niche at that. And with the rush to get bigger underway, I just think this is a really smart and terrific addition by Hachette. In making the announcement, Hachette CEO Michael Peach called Workman the most creative publisher in the industry. And indeed, that may be true. There are publishers that have pioneered the method of combining images and information in a distinct way, Peach said. And that approach has led them to a host of successful franchises, some of which you've just mentioned, What to Expect, for example. They also have the Brain Quest series, and they have the Page a Day calendar. So just great, great brands. So really a great value for Hachette and a very shrewd acquisition, to be sure.
And luckily for Workman employees and readers, Andrew, it looks like Hachette recognizes that special culture you're talking about.
I think so. And, you know, this is somewhat of a happy, if you know, very bittersweet ending for Carolyn Workman, who's the executive chair and president of the company and who's been heading the publisher since 2013, following the death of her husband, company founder Peter Workman. Carolyn Workman's going to retire following the completion of the deal. But one of the reasons it took so long for Workman to be acquired is that, you know, Carolyn Workman was really invested in making sure that the culture that they'd built up over the years was going to remain intact. In fact, in an interview with PW, CEO Dan Reynolds said finding a new owner for the company, which was founded by Peter Workman in 1968, had been in the works for a few years. And it took a lot of time because Workman's number one priority in finding a new home for the company, even more so than price, was the security of its employees. That's just wonderful to hear. And he says the publisher has found that with Hachette. They really understand what makes us tick, Reynolds told my boss, Jim Millia. The publisher currently has about 300 employees. They're scattered across offices in New York, they're in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, North Adams, Massachusetts, and on the West Coast in Portland, Oregon. And it was nice to hear Hachette US CEO Michael Peach echo those sentiments. He said that, you know, Workman's most popular books and products were all developed in-house and that Hachette would be crazy to interfere with the company. They have a unique culture, Peach said, and indeed they do. As my editor Jim Millian noted in his story, Hachette and Workman also fit together in business. Workman is a backlist driven, and we've talked about the importance of backlist sales over the last year, but they're a backlist driven operation. Reynolds said that at some of its imprints, 70 to 80% of annual revenue is generated by its backlist, which is higher than the industry average. Hachette has been open about its desire to expand its backlist, and Peach praised the quality and depth of Workman's roughly 3,500 title backlist. So match made in heaven. And with its unique approach to publishing, which we just talked about, Workman has maintained its own sales force and has sold its line far beyond bookstores. And both Reynolds and Peach said that that sales force is a big opportunity in reaching markets with a broader list from the combined companies. The deal is going to benefit Workman too, of course. Reynolds points out that the kind of publishing that Workman does, it costs a lot of money. You have to invest in all these brands. And well, now that it's freed from sort of having to maintain its own infrastructure, Workman can actually devote more attention to developing new products.
And one last point, and certainly listeners who've been through this with us before know what's coming. The deal, as customary, is pending regulatory approval by the Department of Justice. And antitrust concerns are definitely a front of mind topic in Washington of late, Andrew. What do you expect there?
Yeah, you know, indeed, all the noise that we hear out of Washington is suggesting the antitrust officials might actually start, you know, doing antitrust again. At the end of last week, we learned that a deal on the academic side, Clarivate's acquisition of ProQuest, was delayed over a second inquiry by regulators. And of course, we have the Penguin Random House, Simon & Schuster deal looming. That's a $2.7 billion deal. I forget the exact number. And you have the Harper acquisition of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt looming as well. Another smaller deal, but shrewd one as well, like the Workman deal is for Hachette. So despite increased attention, I still am skeptical. I don't think any of these deals is actually in jeopardy. I could be wrong about that. Don't really know what's going on behind closed doors in Washington. But I do think the Workman deal is absolutely going to sail through. And I would point out, too, that all the proceeds from the sale of Workman are going to go to Whispering Bells, which is a charitable foundation that Carolyn Workman founded with her late husband, Peter Workman. And that may have no impact on the review, but it's a nice touch. It's a nice thought that it's going to a charitable organization. Anyway, I expect the review will not be an issue here at all, especially given Workman's unique publishing niche.
This week's issue included a report about another major indie publisher seeing big results, Andrew, Sourcebooks, this time coming after the indie had sold a little less than half of the company to Penguin Random House.
Yeah, if you haven't read this piece, you know, you should do it. It's on the PW site. Go take a look because it's, you know, it's a great way to explore some of the sales trends that we've been discussing on this podcast over the last year. I'll give you the short version. There's new partners, new initiatives, new staff, new readers, all contributed to a 48% increase in net revenue at Sourcebooks in the first 6 months of 2021 over what was already a record first 6 months in 2020. This according to publisher and CEO Dominique Rocca, who spoke to my boss, Jim Milliot, for the story last week. And yeah, let's be clear. In a year, what is it, year and a half of very strong industry performance, this 48%, that's a cut above for sure. And it really speaks to the impressive work of one of the nation's, perhaps the nation's greatest indie publisher. Among the specific areas of strength highlighted by Rocca in the story was international sales, which is now under the direction of Sean Abraham, who joined Sourcebooks in 2019. And they saw huge gains under Abrams. International sales doubled in the first 6 months of the year over the first half of 2020. That's a pretty astounding performance. And adult fiction sales have also doubled. Sales of young adult fiction increased by 60%. You know, and I've harped on how important this is, fiction sales. And Dominique Rocca, too, said she was heartened by the strength of fiction sales, adding that it suggests more people have picked up the reading habit, a trend that she believes will continue.
Yet we also should note, Andrew, that sales figures appear to be heading gently south in recent weeks. The most recent numbers from NPD's BookScan show yet another decline. Any concern there?
Yeah, so unit sales of print books are continuing to fall, but no, I don't think there's real concern there yet because the declines come amid some tough comparisons with last year when we had a host of mega best-selling titles and things were just on fire. But overall, sales are up over 2019, over the pre-pandemic sales. And again, two things I point out when considering these drops in recent weeks, actually three things. You know, one is that fiction is doing well, which, as Dominique Rocca just, you know, pointed out, is a sign that the industry may have won some new readers, you know, may have won some new customers. Two, there will be blockbusters again. I promise you this, there always are, and there will be blockbusters again. Right now, especially on the nonfiction side, and nonfiction has been carrying publishing for a while now, but we sort of have, I'll call them the B team that's in there now. We have great books, interesting books by like the likes of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, for example. There's a conservative radio host named Mark Levin who's got a best-selling book. But those books aren't selling in huge numbers like some of the more A-list authors. And trust me, the A-list team is warming up, and I'm looking at you, Bob Woodward. Bob Woodward, of course, has a new book coming out. It's called Peril. It's set to drop soon. And the last thing that I'll point out, too, is that bookstore sales are up, and that's good news. if tenuous news. You know, given the surge and the Delta variant across the South, especially, we've talked about this for a couple of weeks on the show now. Fingers crossed that we can get vaccinations cranking and crush the Delta variant. And then we can move on to see a strong end to the third quarter and hopefully a great holiday season after that.
And finally, Andrew, an interesting story this week from your colleague John Marr about Substack and book serialization. We've talked about efforts to serialize books in the past on this show. So tell us a little bit about how Substack might change the game here.
Yeah, so the subscription e-newsletter platform Substack has already made its mark on the media business, right? Lots of people have these Substack e-newsletters that are doing very well. But is it going to have an impact on book publishing? And my colleague John Marr wrote a story. It's on the PW site now. He notes that authors including L. Griffin and John McWhorter and Matt Taibbi are using the platform, the Substack platform, to publish short stories and articles that are exclusive to their newsletter audiences. And now we're starting to see some more experimentation in the book world with Anand Giridharadas, who is an editor at Time Magazine and a political analyst for MSNBC. He's getting into the game with a plan to serialize the first two chapters of his 2014 book, The True American, Murder and Mystery in Texas. He's going to serialize that through his Substack newsletter, The Ink. Over the course of 8 days, Giridharadas is going to publish the first two chapters of the book, broken into four newsletters each, both in text and audiobook. That's interesting to me. The audio is going to be offered for free via Audible. And the excerpts are going to be sent via his newsletter on Substack, and it's going to live in blog form as web pages on The Ink. Giridharadas is also going to open his paid subscriber Zoom sessions to all virtual book club discussions, and that's going to start at the end of the month, I think on August 31st. I think the arrangement is particularly interesting considering that the book has already been published. It was published in 2014, and also its publisher, W.W. Norton, just greenlit the project without any licensing fees. I think that they're going to see a real benefit from that. I think the serialization is going to really juice book sales too. Now, we talked recently about Amazon's recent efforts to serialize books, and other startups like Serialbox have done the same, but nothing has really sort of lit the fuse on this. So I think this is really a great opportunity to extend the reach of book content and drive sales and income. And yet, even in this age of streaming, I wonder why the time has not yet come. And I also wonder if Substack is the platform that can start to change that. It's an interesting piece. It focuses on Giridharadas's seeing an opportunity to expand his audience for a work that frankly saw mediocre sales despite very strong reviews when it was published in 2014, including a starred review in PW. Anyway, I won't say any more. Read the piece. It's on the PW site now. And make a note, because I do think in the coming years, we'll start to see this kind of thing have a much greater impact on the book business, potentially extending the reach of book content to more and more readers who, may not be inclined to browse the aisles of a bookstore.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me on the program.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, academic and scientific research moves methodically downstream from lab bench and laptop to data repositories and peer-reviewed journals, and then finally to public and professional audiences. Making science open will see transformation about discoveries and data become freely available. As open science principles increasingly prevail, how will research be transformed? Martin Delahunty has identified important pain points.
Open science, I think, can be best defined as the practice of science across all science, technology, engineering, mathematical disciplines, such that others can collaborate and contribute, and where the research data and processes are freely available. This should also be under terms that enable reuse, redistribution, and reproduction. And under this broad umbrella of open science, I include peer-reviewed publications, data repositories, workflows and collaboration tools, and science policies and mandates. But what is most exciting for me is that the lexicon of open science is well beyond these components now to an even more intricate and complex landscape.
How open science is shaping research workflow, next on this CCC podcast. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening. Join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.